You know, I can eat a page for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the bees! Not the bees! Ah!
It's like looking in a mirror, only not.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in movie history. I'm Clint Worthington. I'm a senior writer for Consequence and the founder and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And my name is Nathan Rabin, and I am the proprietor of Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and the co-host of this here podcast, which you probably know already, and then the author of many books and the runner of many crowdfunding campaigns.
Yes, indeed. The latest of which being?
The weird coloring to ale. But by the time this drops, my Kickstarter for the sequel to my 2016 project, 7 Days in Ohio, 7 Days in Ohio 2, Return of the Juggalo, will be up and running. I'm going to go back to the gathering for the 8th time. And this time I'm bringing my brother, who I have not seen in 5 years, and my niece, my adult niece, lest you think that I'm taking a five-year-old to the Gathering of the Juggalos. I would not do that. But you can check that out on Indiegogo, and I'm sure I'll be plugging it everywhere, as is my wont, because I needs the money.
Indeed. And so for those of you who are just joining us, first of all, God, why are you picking this lineup? And second of all, we are a podcast that is exploring the respective filmographies of Sir John Travolta and Sir Nicolas Cage to see where their careers and sort of performances and roles intersect. And we are joined by a very good friend of mine, film critic extraordinaire Robert Daniels. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me on. When I heard about the show, you know, I was like, are we talking about mortals? Or are we talking about deities? Yeah. Travolta and Cage count as both.
Indeed. I'm curious. So why did you pick this particular double feature? What interested you about Basic and Sunny?
I thought I hadn't seen either of the movies. Uh-huh. So I was like, oh, okay, cool. I get to see both movies. And then I was rewatching Basic last night, and halfway through, I remembered the entire movie, the twist. I saw Basic when I was 13, so it's been a while. I even remembered the song that the credits ended. Everything got jogged. But yeah, I thought I had never watched either. So I was like, oh, this is cool. I get to watch two different films I haven't seen before.
Yeah, well, you know what? It all comes back together for you in the second watch of Basic, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, I thought I was more familiar with Basic than I was. I spent half of the movie waiting for Samuel L. Jackson to say, yes, they died, and I hope they burn in hell. And then at a certain point, I'm like, oh, wait, that isn't this movie. So I'm like, oh, that must be Rules of Engagement, the other military thriller he did that looks exactly like this movie, just as, you know, this looks exactly like Jennifer's daughter.
It's A Time to Kill.
Exactly. Yeah, it is A Time to Kill. Definitely, definitely. But that's the movie where he yells and is very angry in a performative theatrical.
Oh, that's the one. Yeah. Gotcha. Well, in case we've spoiled it for you, our lineup today is a rather strange one. The double feature we're discussing today is the 2002 military suspense thriller Basic, aka the most ironically titled movie in the world. And strangely enough, we're going to take a slight break from talking about Cage's acting to talk about Cage's directing in the one and only feature he has directed, 2003. I believe 2002's Sunny, starring James Franco as a male gigolo, a male hustler, or as we decided before recording, a muscler. Now, before we talk about those, I want to remind our listeners that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. If you pledge there, we offer patron exclusive podcasts, the next week or so, we're going to be delivering one on the Kevin Hart, John Travolta, recently thrice Emmy nominated Quibi originals, now Roku original, Die Hart, which has now been greenlit for a second season called Die Harter, I believe.
With a vengeance.
I'm sure that'll be the third season. But yeah, stay tuned for that and pledge to the Patreon if you want to hear that. But until then, let's talk about Basic.
Yep.
Tom, it's Bill. I need you to come down here. Something happened. I need your help.
Sergeant Nathan West leads the U.S. Special Forces most elite unit.
My Rangers are warriors.
Deception is their most dangerous weapon.
My Rangers are gods.
And 24 hours ago, he led his men into the jungle and disappeared. But guys like West don't just vanish off the face of the earth. They disappear for a reason. I know. Because he trained me.
Before he left the service, Tom Hardy was the best interrogator I'd ever seen. He could get in your head faster than anyone I know.
This kid we have in interrogation requested a ranger, someone he'd never met. That's you.
I questioned him for 2 hours. He didn't make a sound.
You tried poking him with a stick?
Oh, I bet them Yankees.
What happened out there?
Wait. Don't say it. I'll tell you.
They're dead, aren't they?
It's not like that.
It's not.
You think you know everything. You haven't even scratched the surface.
Am I scratching your surface yet?
Through warfare is deception.
Any spooks involved here? CIA, FBI?
Not exactly.
Things are not what they say.
Hey, Ken will tell you about the other operation.
What other operation?
Conspiracies, puppet masters behind the scenes.
Where are they?
We're here, but we're not here.
You know what he's all about, and you stood by.
How far do you want to go with this?
Want to see what happens when you lie?
What are you doing?
When you lie?
Nathan, recount to me the plot as best you can, or the basic premise of John McTiernan's Basic, the last movie he made before he went to prison.
He's one of the few figures who was sent to movie jail and jail. Pretty much at the same time. Because yeah, it was all over for him after that. And not as a direct consequence of directing the movie Basic, although that also would have been somewhat understandable. I'd first like to start off by saying, damn you, Clint, damn you to hell, for asking me to describe this completely incoherent movie. It feels like it was written by M. Night Shyamalan on speed, because it is just twist after twist after twist after twist after twist, and even the vaguest sort of plot description will contain a number of falsehoods, because this is one of those movies that's like it takes place in Panama, or does it? John Travolta is in it, or is he? So this is basically a different movie than The General's Daughter, although good lord, it does not feel that way. And it is a military whodunit about a training exercise for some really gung-ho military jocks, where they go on a training mission and something goes horribly, horribly awry. And a very fierce drill sergeant, played by Samuel L. Jackson, who is enjoying the holy living hell out of being Samuel L. Jackson. I almost felt like this is one of those movies where it's unfair for him to be having so much fun and to not be sharing it with the audience. That seemed very, very wrong. So what happens is he goes missing and presumed to be dead. Other people are presumed to be dead as well. So John Travolta, who is introduced singing in the shower, drinking straight from a giant bottle of hard liquor, and basically
showing off that incredible dad bod.
I also very much enjoying being John Travolta to the nth power. They really hired them to be movie stars and to not, you know, act or disappear into characters. So John Travolta is an outsider, and he's called in to investigate by television actor Tim Daly, who is playing a character in this movie. He's not television actor Tim Daly. And then he's investigating this with Connie Nielsen, who is a tough but fair and committed and ethical military Seamus. And so together, they kind of get a whole bunch of crazy over-actors into the interrogation room and they ask them what happened, and everybody has a different story. And as the IMDb trivia for this movie adorably feels the need to tell us, this was inspired by the movie Rashomon. Yes. And then a whole bunch of shit happens, and you don't know who's telling the truth and who's lying and what's real and what's not real and why you should care about any of this. You also wonder what's going on with all of the rain. Literally every single scene in here is basically shot in the pounding rain. And I remember it kind of opens with some really cool helicopter shots in the rain. And again, just the dorky kid in me is kind of like, that must have been expensive and difficult to coordinate, and it looks kind of cool. 95 minutes later, when the rain hasn't let up, it's a little bit oppressive. You know, I love John McTiernan. He's directed some of the greatest action movies of all time, most notably Die Hard, with the inspiration for the title of Die Hard. Also Predator, which was a much, much, much better film about a bunch of macho dudes in the wilderness being badasses and killing people. I would have preferred this movie if he Predator had showed up at some point. Also, there are so many goddamn twists and turns in this Meshuggah movie. It wouldn't have seemed that weird. Funny story, there actually was a Predator who committed all of this stuff. And it's one of those movies that is relentlessly devoted to jerking you around over and over and over and over again. It reminded me of Rashomon. It also reminded me, I don't know if you will agree with me about this, but it also reminded me of the movie Identity. It's a little movie by a talented filmmaker making utter schlock, but making it kind of enjoyable in spite of itself. This is one of those stories where, again, there's just so many twists and turns, and you stop caring very early on. It also has some incredibly over-the-top performances from Giovanni Ribisi, who brings a real Mason Verger Truman Capote energy to this project. Well, he's the son of a prominent military man, and it's just
he puts on a character voice kind of like this. And just from his hospital bed, which, according to the trivia, he did not bathe in because he went method for a whole week.
But they also said that the rest of the cast and the crew noticed.
They noticed.
Yeah, and again, it's one thing to suffer for your art. It's another thing to suffer for schlock. Like this incredibly pandering schlock like this. In addition to television actor Tim Daly, we also have New Orleans songbird Harry Connick Jr. In a very fun, very weird, very sleazy performance as a drug dealing doctor who's also Connie Nielsen's ex. And I'm kind of glad that I looked at the trivia for this stupid movie because it was full of like weird non sequiturs. One of which was that John McTiernan had to tell John Travolta and Connie Nielsen to tone down the sexual tension. I just want to say they really listen to that cue because there's almost no sexual tension at
There's
all.
None.
And he's constantly
except for the Travolta character's come-ons to Connie Nielsen, you wouldn't be confused with them having any chemistry at all. Travolta's character's name, by the way, being named Tom Hardy, really threw me.
Well, he's the bane of the military's existence.
He is the bane. Yeah, indeed. Robert, you rewatched this and realized you'd seen it before. What were your sort of thoughts upon rewatching Basic? What were your takeaways?
Oh, what weren't my takeaways?
Yes.
From watching Basic. Yeah, so from the jump, I was like, oh, Samuel Jackson's in this. Oh, Samuel Jackson is yelling. Oh, I hope Samuel Jackson got paid well for this. but I, you know, at first I was intrigued, you know, even with like, you know, the John Travolta dad bod, you know, I don't know. I think Ben Affleck in the way back might've made a slight homage to that.
Maybe. I like to promote it was deliberate. And he's like, tells the director, no, this is an homage to the movie Basic.
Basic Instinct? No, Basic. You've seen it, right? No,
just
General's
Basic.
Daughter? No, Basic. Yeah. Rules of Engagement? No, Basic.
But it begins with a somewhat interesting premise. The first 45 minutes, I was like, okay, you know what? I'm here for this. And then Connie Nielsen shows up and I'm like, okay, well, you know, we got Connie Nielsen and Travolta and they're supposed to be together, but they're not really together, but I guess they're kind of together. We'll see what happens, you know?
Yeah.
This weird Connie Nielsen's going in and out of a Southern accent. I'm okay.
I love that.
sometimes it's really heavy-handed, sometimes it's not. And if I was Harry Connick Jr., he had to have been on set like, what are you doing? Then looked at Rubinsky and said, you know what? Never mind. Connie Nielsen, you keep doing what you're doing.
But, poor Connie Nielsen. She's doing her damnedest to keep this whole thing together because it's so clear that she's really supposed to be the protagonist. It's the same thing with the general's daughter, where like with Madeline Stowe, where it's like it feels like Madeline Stowe's supposed to be the protagonist, and like John Travolta is this like homespun renegade with his like he's dressed like Chef Robert Irvine from Kitchen Confidential or whatever, or Kitchen Impossible, with his like tight black shirt. He looks like Simon Cowell and just like wandered around like he's Dominic Toretto a little bit. It's fucking wild. And I mean, in interviews, the screenwriter James Vanderbilt of the Vanderbilt Vanderbilts, as Nathan told me before filming, and the screenwriter of White House Down and I believe the first Amazing Spider-Man, but also Zodiac, so he usually knows how to handle these kinds of thrillers. Apparently it feels like it's this kind of screenplay where you are so dedicated to staying ahead of your audience in terms of twist. You want to make sure they don't guess the twists. So you structure your story around twist after twist after twist to the point where no one can predict it. And by the end, it's something that no one could have possibly predicted. The thing about good twists is they give you the tools to guess or at least go back and be like, and figure everything out. But there's like in the final 15 minutes, we'll get into it later maybe, but like in the final 15 minutes, they throw three more twists in a row at you that you couldn't have possibly guessed, and only to subvert them too. And it's maddening. And like at a certain point, your brain turns to slush, and like you just, it pools, it sort of pours out of your ear holes like it's a Play-Doh spaghetti machine.
Clint, you didn't guess Taye Diggs is Taye Diggs, but not Taye Diggs, possibly Taye Diggs.
I also felt like this is like there was such an opportunity for like commentary and to like actually talk about things. And that is interesting that the military is such a horrible place that there's a word for when you have to murder your superior officer. You know, that it's like something that happens so intensely, and that like, how do you delineate between like, okay, Samuel L. Jackson is this total hard ass and he's incredibly cruel and he's sadistic, but that's the nature of the military, and it's accepted and it's condoned, it's encouraged by the establishment, versus being so cruel and so sadistic and so over the top that you're a criminal and you're committing a crime. And it felt like if it were a serious movie that were interested in that on any level, that could be really interesting, but it doesn't give them that fuck about any of these characters or any of these things as anything other than like a machine for twists and twists and twists and twists. And again, you just don't fucking care at the beginning, and by the end you super duper mega don't care.
I mean, you can see that someone watched A Few Good Men and said, but what about more?
Yes. What if there were more good men?
So the thing that jogged my memory as though it was an auditory response was when Travolta does that click click sound, and it all came back, and I remembered dying seed basic.
Oh my god. Yeah, well, just because this feels like the kind of movie that was like on pay-per-view in like 2004 2005, or you would like see, you would see the poster, right, like in like video stores in the mid-aughts, and like be like, oh, this, maybe this will be fun, and then you never end up actually renting it.
This was on TBS at least 10 times, I'm telling you. Sure. I watched this at least
10 times. To me this is an airplane movie where this is the kind of thing that you would only see if you were on an airplane, and the other option is reading the Sky Mall. It's not a matter of like this or a different movie. It's this or trying to make small talk with the person next to you. And you don't want to do that. And this is at least a movie. It's a movie with two stars in it. And that's literally all that can be said really for it. But I think it's interesting as a star vehicle. And I mentioned this in my review or my article about it. But there's a late comedian named Brody Stevens. And he used to say, you know, I should get laughs by Caden Solone. Because he had this great rhythm. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there are comedians like Jackie Mason, like Eddie Pepitone, where just their rhythm is so infectious and so funny and amusing that you laugh whether there are jokes or not. And I feel like Samuel L. Jackson is a cadence character actor, where it's like bum ba bum ba bum bum. There's this musicality to it. There's this rhythm. There's this kind of percussive element to it, and it's really, really fun. Even if, again, there's nothing there beyond Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta delivering the biggest movie star performances imaginable.
Yeah, I will say at the like, and this is damning with faint praise, at least it like tries to move. Like in amongst the darkness and the unrelenting rainfall, there are moments where I'm like, one of the things I appreciate about Matiernan's movies is that the camera's always moving and he tries to keep it sort of kinetic in terms of, you know, where the camera's going. And there's a certain sense that, like, especially in the interrogation scenes, those are fun with like Brian Van Holt and who we saw in Wind Talkers in our previous episode. He was like the flamethrower guy in Wind Talkers. One of the fun things about this project is seeing like when actors show up in other projects from the other actor. But yeah, I mean, that was what propelled me for much of it, was just like, at least the camera's moving fun, but I don't give a shit about what's going on right now.
Look, it's a fun movie. And yeah. I was here for every time Samuel Jackson knew why we paid for this.
Yeah, for sure. He didn't even have to be in the movie much.
He brought it. John Travolta, I mean, it's like everyone knows why they should be there, and yet no one really knows why they should be there.
Yeah.
Like, they're all trying to carry the movie at once. And there is a sort of entertainment value to that. And, you know, once again, I mean, I didn't, I'm sorry, I'm reading Wikipedia right now.
Yeah.
And can I just say, the week this was released, what batshit week is this?
Head of state bringing down the house and the core?
Oh my God.
Well, we were busy invading Iraq in 2003, Robert. We were kind of busy.
I mean, the core is like enough. Like the core by itself isn't like pigeons used as projectiles is enough.
Wasn't the premise of Head of State? Wouldn't it be crazy if there was a black man elected president 5 years before the election of Barack Obama?
It was Head of State. Yeah, yeah. And then bringing the House. Yeah, there's that.
It got
then,
me straight tripping, boo. That Eugene Levy was able to thrive after delivering the phrase "You got me straight tripping, boo" speaks to what a giant
Schitt's Creek. Yeah,
amazingly, Head of State was the most believable movie released that week.
Probably.
Oh, God.
Well, and it's getting back to the whole, like, missed opportunity for social commentary. There are also just scenes where he's like, I'm Giovanni Ribisi. My character had his name. I thought it was confusing. And he'd be like, I'm being oppressed because I'm a homosexual. And then Taye Diggs is like, and I'm being oppressed because I'm a black man. And it's like, no, we're all just being jerked around and none of this ever matters. And again, I just felt like this is a movie that spends 95 minutes jerking you around and manipulating you for no reason. At the end, I felt
especially
angry.
When twists depend on a character's race too. Like that's when we find the big reveal. Eric Jr. is like, Ray Dunbar was black.
And it's
like, pushes it on Travolta.
it tries to make you believe that for half the movie that Samuel Jackson is a reverse racist.
it's bizarre. Well, and just underpinning all of this is the idea, like the sheer gymnastics that have to happen for like the eventual truth to be real.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going into these podcast discussions presuming you've seen the film. So if you just really need to hold yourself and wait to watch Basic to find out what the fuck happened in Basic, stop listening now. But
wait,
okay,
I will interject and say, even if you know what the fuck happens in Basic, you really don't know what the fuck happens in Basic.
That's a very good point. So it turns out like literally the only people who actually died are like the two bad people that were in. So it's like this group. It's almost like an Agatha Christie scenario in this bunker, like during a hurricane in Panama during this exercise, and just like six soldiers, including Samuel L. Jackson and like his Army Ranger trainees. And the two who survive, the two who we presume to have survived at the beginning and who are being interrogated and everything, they're the only ones. No, one of them is one of the only bad guys. And then everyone else turns out they're secretly alive. And in the final act, they throw all these other things at you. There's this like secret rogue group of Army Rangers who are there's at once a secret group of Army Rangers that that are taking down the cartels. Or no, yeah. So they're participating in the cartels. They've gone renegade and they're like, we know all their stuff. But it turns out they're actually the good guys. John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, who is alive, are part of that team. All of the missing soldiers were also there, and they had gone undercover, I guess, as Army Ranger trainees to do this.
The longest con in the history of long cons.
And then they all go for shawarma at the very end.
Yes, they all go for shawarma. Well, I mean, they were, you know, they're putting a team together at the very end. They're like, well, it's about time we brought you on, Connie Nielsen. So it turns out this whole thing was kind of like a recruitment audition for Connie Nielsen to join their A team.
They said, we're putting a team together, an A team. We love it when a plan goes together. Yes. That's right. This is an A team movie. Hashtag final twist. And then also, this was so very much as it's John Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson again for the first time since Pulp Fiction. And without this idiotic final twist, they would have no scenes together.
Yeah.
So it's kind of nice to see them together, but it's like, boy, this is not quite as good as Pulp Fiction. That was a slightly better, slightly more memorable pairing of these particular.
Yeah. When you pit basic up against Pulp Fiction, like the scales kind of balance a little bit before slightly teetering in Pulp Fiction's direction. But yeah. Oh man. Yeah. And the thing is, like, that last scene, at least, like, it has a fun little, like, hangout movie energy to it, or it's sort of like, it feels like the movie itself has thrown up its hands. It's like, look, it's the end of the movie, who fucking cares, let's just, this is the wrap party basically. Well, roll
the funny
credits.
Thing is that, like, if you truncate the entire movie and you made it into a like 5-minute scene or something like that, and then you began with the hangout thing, you would have a very interesting movie.
Oh my god, no, it felt like a pilot for an A-team like thing. You know what I mean? Like, now we're gonna watch them take the jobs that no one else will take.
This was before cinematic universes. This was gonna be a cinematic universe.
The BCU.
I like that this and Domestic Disturbance, they both broadcast how generic they will be with their titles. You know, they might as well just be like action, you know, movie, military thriller.
You know exactly what part two would have been called. It would have been called Back Two.
I would have preferred Basic with Two Eyes to form the Roman numeral two, but that's just me. Oh god, so basic. And here's the thing: we've been ragging on the plot and like all the twists upon twists upon twists. But Robert, you mentioned that it was sort of fun for you to watch. Do you want to talk more about sort of what perversely appealed to you about it?
Everything.
Yeah.
It really is. Sometimes you just watch something and you're like, they got approval for this. someone sent Travolta this script. He read it and it said, this tracks. Wait for it. And then, you know, Travolta called up Samuel Jackson like, hey, we got to do it. Bring it back.
It's been a while since we've done some movies together. Yeah. He's having fun. Sauntering around.
Everyone is having fun in this movie. Everyone's doing their thing. And like I said, everyone who appears in this movie, they're exactly who you expect them to be. Mm-hmm. You expect Samuel Jackson to be the loudmouth. You expect Travolta to kind of be, you know, I don't know, this like charming, like scoundrel, right? Yeah. You expect everyone here. Everyone plays their role. And plus, like, there's just at some point, you, like, as you said, you just throw your hands up and you're just like, you know what? This movie is telling me exactly what it wants to be. It is exactly what it is. And I just have to accept it and just enjoy the ride. And I enjoyed the ride at some point, even when there was blood vomit. I enjoyed the ride.
Oh my god. That was incredible. Well, and here's the thing. We have a tacit rule at Travolta Cage, especially with the Travolta related movies. If Travolta sings or dances, it is a good movie. And we get both of those things. We get him singing in the shower at the beginning, and then when Connie Nielsen is tracking them through the streets of Panama during like Carnival or whatever celebration that is, we see him like dancing with like Brian Van Hull. Yeah. It's so great. It's just, again, like, that just feels like the tacked on thing that's just like just gonna have a good old time. And Harry Connick Jr. sings too.
He's not dancing to a fifth of Beethoven.
Yes.
That would be a little bit unfortunately too overt of a throwback, but thankfully that's true of the other movie.
Very true. Yeah, that's right. That did happen. And we'll get to that soon enough. But do we have any final thoughts on Basic?
I had no idea what was going on for about 60% of this picture. And I don't think that necessarily did took away from my enjoyment of it. It's just a very weird, confusing movie. And I'm not sure it's really worth paying a lot of attention. I feel like this is a movie that you can see while you're folding your laundry or mopping your floor and not miss anything.
Mm-hmm. Look, can I just say, any film that has two needle drops of Black Betty,
yes,
that's it. Yeah. And funny, this movie, it's like someone like slipped on the mixing desk and like played Black Betty early before the credits. Like, let's give it a little taste.
I feel like between Basic and Kung Pao Enter the Fist, Black Betty had a couple good years between 2002 and 2003. No, I fully buy that. All right, cool. Oh, by the way, I do think it's very, very cheeky that one of the most repeated lines in this movie is, all we got to do is tell the story right. Because I wish someone had told James Vanderbilt that. But anyway.
When they say that, that's the twist.
Yeah.
That was the moment I was like, he's in on this fucking joke.
Yeah,
too,
oh, he fucking knows.
He wrote White House Down, you know? He knows that he's writing a very silly movie.
Also, if you lose enough in life, what you are is a loser. That's a real Fortune 50.
I mean, where's the lie?
Yeah, exactly. It's detected. All right. Well, let's move on from Basic to something just as confusing, but way more bizarre, which is the Nicolas Cage directed 2002 film Sonny.
From Nicolas Cage in his directorial debut.
Oh, baby, Sonny.
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 Oh, my God. Are you still working? Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Heard a great deal about you.
Love.
Come on, Sonny, now, baby.
Patience. Said you wanted to get what you paid for.
Right. You don't know Sonny like I do. Because he don't care a damn thing about you.
I fell into a burning ring of fire.
I don't know what happens next.
You want to get serious or what?
What are you going to do?
Mom, I'm not going to do that kind of work anymore. I don't want to screw all night anymore. I don't have the stomach for it.
You gotta face the fact that this is all there is.
I just don't want to get old and not have anything to show for it.
I ain't never been out on a real date before.
It's time you learn. You just be yourself, right?
You're a strange man.
You're 26 years old, Sonny. How much longer do you think you can keep this up?
As long as I have to.
Hell of a lifestyle we got going here.
Well, it's always better at night than it is in the morning.
Golden Globe winner James Franco. Golden Globe winner Brenda Blethyn. Mina Suvari. Harry Dean Stanton in a film by Nicolas Cage. Sonny.
Now, Robert, would you like to take the basic premise of Sonny on?
Oh, man.
You can't see this is a podcast, but Robert just hit his head in his hands.
Look, okay, so the basic premise of Sonny.
No, we're not talking about Basic anymore, Robert. We're on to Sonny.
The bare bones premise of Sonny is Sonny is played by the James Franco. Let's just give
him
James Franco.
You must eventually be named.
Yes. And he plays the son of a brothel owner in New Orleans. And he has recently been discharged from the army. He has come back home and he has a job waiting for him. Well, he has two jobs waiting for him.
Yeah.
One job he wants, one job he does not want. The job he wants is through an army buddy. You know, he thinks he's going to get him out of the job he doesn't want, which is as a gigolo.
Yeah.
Not only a gigolo, but a gigolo who is employed by his brothel mother.
Yes.
And so when he comes back to these two jobs, he also meets this woman named Carol, who is a new invitee to this brothel. And it really is about basically Sonny wanting to get out of this life. Yet, in the great words of Corleone, every single time I try to get out, they drag me right back in.
Yeah. Ooh, mama. So, yeah, whenever actors decide to eventually direct movies, I feel like it is such an incredible insight into their psyches, because this is the project that they decided to put their stamp on. And Sonny, I feel like I know so much more and so much less about Nick Cage as a person after watching Sonny. I think it's very interesting that one of the most important pieces of trivia about this movie is that after Tommy Wiseau saw Sonny, he finally was like, James Franco, you can play me in Disaster Artist, because this movie looks and feels like The Room. It is even shot like The Room. Lots of widely lit basic set dressing, and that exact same kind of camera that they eventually used for The Room. And yeah, it's a weird Tennessee Williams mess, starring Brenda Bleden, who is incredibly bad in this. Brenda Bleden, who I just seen Secrets and Lies, and she's incredible in that. God, but seeing her in this and Secrets and Lies, it's very clear she's a very specific type of actress who you can use really well or you can use really poorly. She has a particular kind of fragile, brittle melodrama about her. And that works best as this incredibly beaten down North London woman whose life has just upended. Less so when she has to play Blanche Devereaux and when she has to say Goyle instead of girl. And say, you know, it's my birthday. And it's just, oh my God. It's so like community theater glass menagerie. And it's fascinating to watch.
Well, and I feel like if you're somebody who is a procurer of flesh, if you are a pimp or you are a madam, I just saw Zola incidentally about a week and a half ago. And that kind of clarified some of my thoughts about this, because one of the things I loved about Zola was I felt like it was a movie about prostitution and sex work that wasn't like all of the other movies. And by all of the other movies, I specifically mean the movie Sonny, where there's just incredible sentimentality. And her character, again, you have to have some sort of charm. You know, some sort of appeal, or you have to be scary. You have to have some reason why somebody would want to give you all of their money and have sex with strangers for you. And there's nothing. She's such a repellent human being. And it's so over the top. And she's like, oh, Sonny, the only thing you're good at is selling that sweet, sweet dick for mama. That's all you're ever gonna do. And it's like, why would anybody spend time with this monster? This is like the worst person in the world. And it's just so, and again, I really like Mina Suvari. Watching Zola, I remember thinking about the movie Stuck. If you guys have seen that, it's a Stuart Gordon's final film. It's really, really good. It's one of my name is Zola, sort of based on true story as well. And again, there's just this specificity and this realism of this is a character who is in a really bad place and is trying to get out of it. And there's just such a sense of verisimilitude, whereas here she's such a cliche. She's such a hooker with a heart of gold. And yeah, that the one thing that I liked about this movie, and I really, really liked it, was I thought that Harry Dean Stanton gives a legitimately great performance. We watched Domestic Disturbance a couple of episodes ago, and same sort of deal, where there's not a moment of truth in that, except that Steve Buscemi is really entertaining. And when he's on screen, you believe the movie, and you're engaged with the movie. And part of it is that Harry Dean Stanton gives an understated performance. He plays a human being. He plays somebody who's lived in. He plays somebody with a history. Whereas all these other, it's just an acting showcase. And one of the things they do with James Franco is that his character has a lot of anger issues, which means that he's soft and he's gentle and he explodes with rage constantly. And these giant, giant actorly moments. And they're just so
usually when he's fully nude.
Yes. Yeah, generally, but it's just like, ugh, like I'm getting so tired of him exploding with rage every 20 minutes. Like, you can set your fucking watch to when Sonny will be like, oh, you're treating me like I'm a prostitute. And that's the other thing too, is that like, he's like the most famous person in New Orleans. They're like, hey, there's Sonny. He's selling dick for his mother, who's a famous brothel owner. Let's say hi to Sonny. Hey, Sonny, you gonna sell any cock today? It's like, what universe does this take place in? It just reminded me a lot of Zandali, which we wrote about earlier, which is a similarly sex-saturated New Orleans motion picture. And I felt like it wasn't until Bad Lieutenant Port of Call New Orleans that he figured out how to make the most of the insanity and the flavor and the color and the texture of New Orleans without being completely overwhelmed and overshadowed by it.
Turns out making a movie in New Orleans isn't so easy after all. I'm going to go. Bye. It's one of those, it's one of those weird things where like, oh man, it reminded me of Zandali, of course, but it also reminded me of Deadfall, down to Nick Cage's cameo as a bizarre character named Acid Yellow late in the film, with a weird prosthetic, and he's in like a yellow like suit with a Austin Powers lace cravat doing rails, where he's like, daddy's gonna suck Sonny's dick, and it's wild.
I sort of said in my piece there that it's as if he talked to the costume designer, said, I want to look like Willy Wonka, Tony Clifton, Humpty Hump, and all at the same time. You know, like, I want that energy, but gay and on ass. And also there's, I guess, something you see in a lot of movies too, where this idea of like, oh, a straight man having sex with men for money is the ultimate degradation. And it's the ultimate debasing himself. There's no coming back from it. And this is, again, a movie with the protagonist who commits a hate crime, who's terrible to women. And I feel like this movie is way more sympathetic towards him than it should be. You know, I feel like there's a sense of like, well, he's had a really hard life and he's full of anger and like, if you had his horrible life, you would be a terrible person too. And again, I just felt like this is a movie that, again, and there are moments too, like I mentioned this earlier, that like during the bottom out scene where he goes to Acid Yellow and is like, I'm ready to debase myself. Like, let's do it. The song A Fifth of Beethoven by Walter Murphy plays. And that is, of course, you know, one of the jams from Saturday Night Fever. So over the course of 3 minutes, you have this famous song from Saturday Night Fever. You have Nicolas Cage, the star of Face Off, and you have him saying to his goons of James Franco, because again, just committed a hate crime, I want you to cut his face. I want you to cut his face. I'm like, you're getting so close to just saying cut his face off. Face off, face off, face off. Why aren't I watching Face Off right now?
Chasing him around with like a cane sword. That's a wackadoo scene. At the same time, it's the most I enjoyed myself, because the rest of it is just so much warmed over melodrama, where it's just a slack jawed James Franco just being like, just came back from the terror. I don't want to get back into that old life. And we all know what's going to happen.
And it's like,
he doesn't have any chemistry with Mina Savari. And
well, he like goes down to Texas to get a job working in a bookstore. And in the university and I live in, a handsome military man would probably be able to get a job as a bookstore and a clerk without too much of a problem, but here it's treated as an impossible fantasy that of course is destroyed. And again, this is one of the few times in which IMDb is mildly interesting, and that they pointed out that the guy who almost got the job is played by Scott Kahn, and that Kahn's father, James Kahn, portrayed Sonny Corleone in The Godfather, directed by Nicolas Cage's uncle, who I'm just gonna say right now, better filmmaker than his nephew.
And perhaps slightly. But at the same time, Nick Cage never directed Jack, so I don't know if it evens out. Maybe Nick Cage's Godfather is just somewhere in the future. But yeah, I don't know. I there's also stuff in the trivia about like researching the role, James Franco like visiting male strip clubs in New Orleans and following male prostitutes around. And I don't know, given the sort of tarnished nature of his reputation, shall we say, of late, and I'm like, ooh, that the sort
sort of has a weird sort of stink to it. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's also just weird laugh out loud melodramatic moments. Like one of the most intimate scenes in the film is Harry Dean Stanton talking to Seymour Cassel, who is also somehow in this movie. Yeah. And then eventually sort of winning the chess game or whatever, and then immediately getting the car. Slam, car crash, huge explosion.
It's like something out of like a Zucker Brothers movie. You know, it's basically, it's my lucky day, everything's really good for me. And then boom, he's like basically set exploding on fire. And again, it's like it's so really appropriate that Harry Dean Stanton gives like this lovely, understated, lived-in performance.
Yeah.
And then again, he literally like gets blown up by a truck at the end. And then that is, you know, it's like again, you know, the entire goddamn moment that he's introduced, like, oh, he must be his father. Son,
he was your father.
Oh, good God. Oh my sweet blessed Lord. Yeah, it's
he just wanted to stick around, you know. It kind of reminded me of Rumblefish. Like the Dennis Hopper character in Rumblefish.
Don't put Rumblefish.
Not favorably.
That's not fair to Rumblefish at all.
I know.
If this were made in 1983, Nicolas Cage would have been the star.
Sonny and Rumblefish, two films of equivalent quality.
Well, I feel like Nicolas Cage has that kind of explosive sexuality, that kind of magnetism, that like James Dean quality. And here's the thing is like James Franco can be really good. I mean, he was starring in Freaks and Geeks not too earlier before this, but he's so over the top in this and all of his like screaming melodramatic scenes. Again, it just feels like the screenwriter and the director are just serving him as an actor and misserving him by having him go as big and as broad and as angry and method-like at any moment. There's also, you know, at one point, James Franco was supposed to direct Zola before Me Too happened. Like, okay, that would be a really bad choice. And I feel like his performance here shows that he would have been a bad director for that material and that his take on this world, again, is very melodramatic and very fake and very And again, I was like surprised to discover that this was semi-autobiographical and it was written by an actual, you know, male prostitute, because it all feels so phony and it all feels so fake and it all feels like a movie that's inspired by other movies about hustlers and not real life.
Right. And then, you know, of course, it takes place in the early 80s, and the only indicator we really get for that is a Rush song plays once.
There were a couple of needle drops there.
Yeah, but like that was the first time I'm like, oh, this is supposed to be in the past. Okay, gotcha.
Well, actually, when it opens, you think it's even more in the past.
Yeah.
You think he's like a 1940s GI returning home from the war.
Right.
Like when it first opens, you're like, oh, well, this is interesting, Nick Cage. Okay, cool. What I love is that like New Orleans is like depicted as some small podunk town where like everyone knows James Franco's reputation. There's not a corner he could go to. Everyone knows.
It's basically Grover's Corners.
At one point, he literally says, "Half the people here know I'm a hustler." It's like, how the hell do you know half of the people? If I were the mayor of New Orleans, half the people would know me and know what I was up to.
Right, right. Also, based on that early scene in the film where Mina Suvari is giving that car dealership guy head for the Pontiac, I'm kind of also not sure if Nick Cage knows how blowjobs work. Because that's another scene that felt like The Room, where there was like sexual activity happening, but things weren't positioned in proper ways. Where like, so I feel like I can understand where Tommy Wiseau watches this and feels a kinship with not just Nick Cage, but James Franco here, where there's a specific style to the ineptitude that they share. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of like almost like basic, right? Where like you see Nick Cage and you hear the concept, right? And you think, you know what? That's a really good concept, trying to, you know, humanize a male sex worker and really kind of ahead of its time in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think, well, Nick Cage, right? He's going to get these great performances from the actors on set. And he's a Coppola, you know, it's going to go great. What could go wrong? And then it plays for 10 minutes and you're like, everything could go wrong.
And I think that's the double-edged sword of being an actor directing other actors, right? Because I feel, especially an actor like Cage, who I feel, especially when he is well-used, he's well-used a lot of times when people let him go big and let him follow his instincts. I wonder if, as a director, he is similarly inclined to let his actors just sort of go and he has kind of zero notes. That's kind
kind of how the performances feel. The performances feel like all the actors were able to, were granted the ability to go with their first instinct, and that's it. And so I wonder what that is. Or maybe he feels too close to them because a lot of people, like with Harry Dean Stanton, he's worked with before. And so maybe he feels intimidated. I don't know. This is me trying to like reverse engineer the psychology of Nicolas fucking Cage directing a movie. But I don't know. It's a really interesting case study for
it. Well, in the final scene there in particular, you kind of get the sense of like the movie that he was trying to make, which was kind of Saturday Night Fever, but with sex work, kind of this very gritty, this very dark, you know, this very lived in character study of like these, you know, sort of desperate, sad hustlers on the fringes of society trying to make a go of it. And you just fail spectacularly. And it just doesn't feel real and doesn't feel lived in. It feels like hokey bullshit melodrama. There's some nice moments, but the entirety of it is just so screamingly fake it makes it hard to believe in these people and their struggle. I'm also like, why should I care? He's just kind of an asshole, you know? And there can be charisma. I mean, my God, John Travolta was a fucking asshole in Saturday Night Fever, but you have to have a magnetism. You have to have a depth. There has to be something there. And I just feel like Sonny's just a beautiful blank. I also hated that the old idea of like, oh, he's a hustler, but he knows how to read books. And his mother's like, y'all don't know how to read. Y'all ain't never going to read no book. You're going to work in no bookstore. Sell some cock for mama. Come on, please. Sell that sweet penis for me. It's like, oh, Jesus. And again, Brenda Bleffin, great actress. I was very embarrassed for her. And that's because she gives a very big, very bad performance.
Like I said, it's Blanche Devereaux. It's like Blanche Devereaux if she was a madam. Which is wild. Like this is the kind of movie where like Carol tells Sonny, now I know why mother calls you a natural born whore. And like
so there's that's like not scenes the reason. Where bum, bum, bum,
yeah, bum. The mom calls him Adonis, and I'm like, man, this is squeaky. And I know it's supposed to be squeaky, but like I don't know how I feel about the squeakiness here. I don't know. I don't know.
You don't like being told that in bed at all.
I don't like to be reminded of my mother right after.
Which is because your mother did prostitute you from a young age, did she not?
Indeed.
Not to tell tales out in school or anything, but
exactly.
Very universal story.
Illinois south of I-80 is just it's desperate times. But anyway, yeah. So Sonny. So I don't know. Based on what we've seen of Sonny and. Who knows how much he's grown, evolved as an actor since. I mean, and there's a reason we're talking about him for a whole podcast. But would you like to see another film directed by Cage? And if so, what genre?
You know what? I would actually. I would like to see. I mean, because, you know, I don't know. Sometimes it starts off rough. I mean, I'm blanking on the actor now who's like first directed film was terrible, but is like slowly improved. I mean, look, what I would say is that if RZA, Wu-Tang Clan, could go from where he was on his first film, where that first film is dreadful.
Is that Man with the Iron Fists?
I think so. It's dreadful, right?
I thought it was fine.
Cutthroat City, which is actually a pretty good movie, I think. I was like shocked, right? If he could greatly increase, you know, from that to that, then I'm interested on what Nick Cage...
Yeah.
Has in him. And I also think Nick Cage, as well have known, has known, has been in a lot of bad films the last.
What? How dare you, sir?
The last decade or so. And I wonder if, you know, he has learned to make a film by watching other bad films.
Cultivating a list of what not to do.
And so, you know. I think he's of course a talented actor, and he of course has quote unquote filmmaking in his blood. But
I think he's a lot more in his bloodstream.
He's Roman Coppola's cousin, for God's sakes.
But I would love to see what he would do now after having a lot of time of living a failure, right? As opposed to 03, 04 when this came out, right? I think around that time, where he was kind of at his height. when he was kind of at his most pretty big-headed. I would like to see what a humbled Nick Cage would do with his next filmmaking opportunity.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, just to bring it closer to the film itself, James Franco is somebody who directed a lot of very bad movies that I saw, and a bunch of bad movies that nobody saw, and then pulled it all together with Disaster Artist, which I thought was very funny and very sure-footed, and I'm not sure I ever want to see him direct a movie again. I'm not sure he should be employed. But yeah, I definitely, I also would like to see it. Maybe an underdog sports comedy. That might be an interesting genre for Nicolas Cage.
What sport should Nick Cage tackle?
Rugby, girls hockey.
Get him started directing an episode of Ted Lasso.
Volleyball. Come on, there are so many places he could go.
Yeah.
Actually, I wonder how he would do with just a straight-up biopic. A film that tends to lend itself toward method, something he's really good at.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah. I also would be very curious to see him direct an action picture, considering how many action pictures of varying levels of quality he would have done. Because I feel like he would do the trying to be John Woo thing with at least the experience of being in a John Woo picture or two, you know, so... I don't know. That would be kind of fun. But I also, I mean, I would almost, you know, I would think the biopic idea is a really good one. I think maybe even taking another crack at like a serious sort of indie kind of drama thing, maybe nothing quite as Tennessee Williams as this, but I don't know, maybe something more intimate, more actorly. Because as you said, he has very much evolved and grown as an actor. He knows that he's doing schlock, but he also knows when to swing for the fences and do some interesting stuff like Pig, which I think is great. And yeah, I don't know. It's a really interesting question. And you know, Nick, if you're listening here, give us your movie ideas. We want to see them happen. So yeah, I think unless we have any other thoughts on Sonny, we are going to reach the stage of the podcast that we like to call Cage Match, where we pit these two films against each other and decide by whatever subjective measure we might, which one is quote unquote better and moves on to whatever second round we would even do if we're doing some kind of bracket for these. So Robert, I'll start with you. Between Basic and Sonny, which would you say wins quote unquote?
Well, I can watch Basic without feeling like I need to take a shower afterwards. So
it's raining, so you feel like you're taking a shower the whole time.
So I would choose Basic just on the pure entertainment value. Never bored with that movie.
Yeah. Nathan, what about you?
I feel like these are neither is a big winner, but I also would choose Basic just because it is engagingly mediocre. You know, there's just a lot of stuff going on, and it doesn't. Yeah, whereas Sonny is actively bad, and I feel most bad because I feel like Sonny is really going for something. It's clearly a story that's important to Nicolas Cage. It's a story that he wanted to tell. It's a story that he felt an emotional connection to, but it just doesn't work on any level. And other than Harry Dean Stanton's wonderful performance, there's not really. And Sammy Seymour Cassell is always a pleasure to see. It's nice to see the two of them together. Like, yeah. Sonny is a bit of a nightmare. And you can also just watch Nicolas Cage's Acid Yellow on YouTube and pretty much get all you need from this movie.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. Sonny commits the cardinal sin of being a bad movie that isn't even interesting enough to really explore on a scene-to-scene basis. So like it really just feels like a super missed opportunity. Whereas Basic has those it succeeds on fundamentals. I think there's like a solid cast that's just like having a lot of fun being weird characters. And at a certain point, the twists on twists on twists just grow ad absurdum to the point where you just surrender yourself to it. And you're like, yeah, sure. They're an elite super squad that's secretly alive the whole time. Why not? Let's do it. And you get to hear Black Betty multiple times. So yeah, congratulations, Basic. You won by a hair. You won sort of just by default by not being Sonny. Congratulations. And I think that pretty much wraps up this particular episode of F and Birds Presents Travolta Cage. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's a real treat to see you. And why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find you doing it.
You can find me anywhere, much like Sonny. but let's see. I think tomorrow, I don't know when this is coming out.
This might come out at the very latest. It's coming out next Wednesday.
Okay. Well, by next Wednesday, I'll have something in Vulture about the Emmy snubs that happened earlier today. Let's see. I've got a review coming for RogerEbert.com. A couple of things coming for Polygon. It should be in a week or so. I'll be reviewing The Green Knight. I have a monthly action streaming column for the New York Times that should be dropping in a couple of days. And let's see. And I have something coming out for the playlist, I think. I think I might be reviewing the new G.I. Joe for them. So.
Oh, yeah. G.I. Joe Origins. Yeah, Snake Eyes.
I did not know that there was a new G.I. Joe movie. I'm out of the loop.
Yes. Oh, boy, is there. Yeah, I was going to say, Robert, I feel like it would have been shorter to ask you where you're not writing, because you're everywhere these days and well deserved. And where are you on Twitter?
At 812 Film Reviews.
Excellent. Well, listeners, that wraps it up for this episode of Effin' Birds Presents Travolta Cage. Thank you so much for listening. Subscribe to us if you're not already on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. Wherever that is, please rate and review us. It helps us out a ton. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Travolta Cage. You can email us questions at travoltacagepod@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter at Clint Worthing. Nathan's on Twitter at Nathan Rabin. Read his write-ups on the films we're watching at NathanRabin.com. Plus so much more. If you want to support our stuff, go to patreon.com/TravoltaCage. We will give you patron-only podcast episodes at least every month. Thanks so much for listening. And now if you'll excuse me, I gotta poo.